Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in moments, we'll hear from the economist Heather Boucher about inequality. And then at the bottom of the hour, the young journalist George Joseph will tell us about Teach for America. First, the briefest of comments on the election. As appalling as the Republican Party is, and it is, it's remarkable how little the Democrats have in the way of a positive message. Sometimes it seems that all they have to say is, Republicans are mean and stupid, and we're the not Republicans, though a generation ago they would have been liberal Republicans. Tuesday's results are further proof that vile and energetic will beat bland and listless any day. Of course, the problem of the Democrats is deeply structural, a neoliberal party of business that has to pretend otherwise for electoral reasons. On to my first guest. Heather Boucher is an economist and the director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Heather will explain what it is in the interview. Some of the center's recent work is featured in the current issue of the Washington Monthly, which is on the web at washingtonmonthly.com. Heather Boucher. Let's talk Piketty. Back in the peak of Piketty mania some months ago, I recall some people saying that feminists really need not engage with things like the capital stock and the wealth distribution, that's for the big boys. You think that feminists need to engage with Piketty. Why is that?
Well, you made me laugh there, Doug, because you know this whole idea that somehow women or feminists don't need to deal with money is probably an age-old idea. You know, honey, don't worry about that. Just let the men take care of it. And nothing, of course, could be further from the truth. In fact, you know, Thomas Piketty's book, in the book, he talks a lot about how the trends in income inequality and this rising inequality we've seen growing in terms of incomes across people in the United States and in other countries around the world, that this has the potential, and we're seeing evidence that this is calcifying into greater inequality and wealth. And if you think about what that means, and particularly what that means for women, nothing I think could be more important for feminists to start thinking about. Because if how much money you have or your standard of living is dependent more on how much money your parents give to you vis-a-vis an inheritance or some stock of capital that you're either given or that you marry into, then that means that the way you're going to make your way in the world isn't going to be as much about your own smarts or how much education you get or what you do on the job, but it's going to be about whether or not you can access this stock of capital that somebody has, either your dad or this guy that you're going to marry or something like that. And that's a world that I think we all think we left behind a really long time ago, but if Tomas is right and high income inequality will calcify into higher wealth inequality, and this will have an impact on the decisions of young people, then this could very well have real implications for gender equality moving forward.
All right. Now to turn to your organization and this research you've been developing in the Washington Monthly. You're beginning to roll out some findings. So first of all, tell us about the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Well, we are a new organization. We're about to celebrate our first year since our launch, which was in the middle of November of last year. And we're both a DC-based think tank as well as a grant-making institution. And our fundamental question is whether and how economic inequality affects economic growth and stability. So stuff like Thomas Piketty's work is, of course, very fundamentally important to our mission in terms of understanding the implications of inequality for our society and for what makes the economy move forward. Last year, we gave out, in the summer, we gave out about $500,000 in grants to academics all over the country. We gave out 16 grants, I think six of which were to young scholars, either postdocs or graduate students. looking at the various ways that the various channels through which inequality could affect economic growth. So, for example, looking through human capital, you know, how is it that inequality affects the kinds of education that young people get or the access that young children have to early childhood education, which then has an effect on the skills that they have as adults, which then has a very direct effect on our economic growth. And so we're looking at human capital, at the implications of inequality for demand and consumption, the implications that inequality has on the institutions around us, everything from government to corporate governance and everything in between, as well as the implications of inequality on entrepreneurship and innovation. So those are the four buckets that we're looking at. And as I said, we're giving out grants in those areas and also doing in-house research and trying to convey what all of this means for policymakers.
And you mentioned at the end there entrepreneurship and innovation, and I've been struck looking at the stats over the last years by the erosion of what appears to be the erosion of the entrepreneurial spirit in the U.S. I mean, we don't see a very high level of startups, business startups, and this country used to be all about, you know, for whatever its vices and virtues, there was an economic dynamism around, and that seems to have been ebbing over the last decade or so to the point where business startups are at a very low level, which is important for employment growth over the longer term. What do you see in the relation of this inequality to that erosion of entrepreneurship?
You know, that is a really, it's such an interesting question. And I think, you know, I want to pivot back again to the Piketty issue, because one of the things that we see from the evidence that's out there, and I'll just also start by noting that this summer we actually didn't give out any grants in the area of entrepreneurship because we didn't actually get any proposals in that area. This isn't really an area that economists have studied enough, and so I'd love to leave your listeners, especially those of whom are researchers, that this is something that I think we need to know a lot more about. Having said that, what we do know from the Kauffman Foundation is that most people who are entrepreneurs actually come from middle-class backgrounds. They don't come from very wealthy families or very poor families. And when you think about that intuitively, it, you know, it makes sense. If you're very poor, you maybe don't have access to capital, or you don't have a good education, or you don't have access to the science lab where you learned how to build the next electric car or whatever it is that you're going to innovate. And if you're very rich, maybe you don't need to make any money, or you don't have that sort of that fire in your belly because, you know, you're kind of well taken care of. So what we see is that they typically come from middle class families, and that the economic security plays a really big role. You know, that risk of being an entrepreneur is multiplied when you add to it, you know, whether or not you're going to have health insurance, or whether or not that, you know, how that's going to affect whether or not you'll be able to have any economic security at all. And of course, the United States has a labor market where workers are much more insecure than they are in other countries. So the risks of entrepreneurship are magnified, not just by the risks of whether or not your idea will fail or succeed, but that the cost of failure is higher because it could mean bankruptcy, or it could mean going without a very important medical treatment or something if you can't afford health insurance. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, we're seeing a decline in the United States or a lack of entrepreneurship here because it is so hard. And with rising inequality, this is one of the things that we would expect to see. And I just want to note before we leave this topic that the idea of entrepreneurship and inequality, you know, for a long time, you know, you might have thought of like, oh, well, inequality is good for entrepreneurship because that gives people the incentive to go out and, you know, create that next big thing because I'll get that big payoff. But, you know, looking back at the data that we're seeing now, it looks like it's actually that security that gives people the foundation to go out and be entrepreneurs. And the payoff is important, but that may not be as important as the platform.
Well, also a lot of what passes for entrepreneurship is developing technologies that were fundamentally discovered with public funds, and we're starving the public sector.
Well, definitely. And I think, I mean, you know, not in the technology area, but certainly every time I read a newspaper article about Ebola, I'm really wishing that we had made those investments in that young scientist to discover the cure for that long before it became a bigger public health issue. So, yes, certainly.
And now, what about the trend towards inequality? I mean, this is now thoroughly established. No one really doubts the fact that we've gotten substantially more unequal over the last several decades, right?
Certainly. I mean, you know, when I first became an economist many years ago now, there was a question as to whether or not inequality was rising or whether it was just whether or not benefits like health insurance or pensions were somehow making up for inequality in wages. And I think now the jury is definitely out that we've seen rising inequality across a wide number of dimensions. Wages, family incomes, a lot of measures of job quality in terms of, you know, whether or not people have access to pensions and 401ks or what kinds of health insurance they get, that you're seeing a greater dispersion there. We're seeing a greater dispersion in terms of wealth. So you're seeing inequality growing there as well. And you're also seeing a variety of ways that this inequality is playing out inside families. So one of the trends that if you talk to demographers, they'll tell you a lot about is this greater family instability that we're seeing that has kind of occurred alongside these changes in the economy. You've seen these changes inside families where families at the bottom half of the income distribution are increasingly unstable, whereas families at the top are pulling apart in terms of their marriage patterns, and when they're having children, they tend to have children later in life when they have more of a sort of job history and resources under their belt. So you're seeing the inequality is now playing out in the economy along a variety of axes.
You mentioned the instability of marriage and having children. I think there are some pundits who would argue that the instability of the marital relation is the cause of the inequality and poverty problem, but that's reversing cause and effect, isn't it?
That's the way I certainly read the evidence. You know, there's a lot of research out there. I mean, this is a really big issue, and of course it feeds right into the culture wars, but there's a lot of evidence that, especially the instability that you see in jobs and the job opportunities, have a direct effect on family stability in a variety of ways, both in terms of marital patterns, but also in terms of raising the next generation. There's some really interesting research that shows that parents who have who work non-traditional schedules, that has an impact on the development of their children at a very young age, which then, of course, has a long-term human capital effect on the skills and attainment of those children as they grow into becoming adults. And there was also, I mean, I would point to a really nice piece that was in the New York Times maybe 2 months ago now that Jodi Kantor wrote that followed this woman whose name escapes me now, but she was a Starbucks worker, and the whole story was about the difficulty with her hours because Starbucks, and they actually changed their policy a couple, like 24 or 48 hours after this newspaper story came out in the New York Times, but Starbucks had this policy where people didn't know their schedule until a few days in advance, and in fact, there were a lot of cases where people had to both close the store and then be back a few hours later to open it the next morning, and all of this, of course, causes chaos for families. But to get back to this family point, one of the really interesting things in the article was how the boyfriend of this woman at this store, and she has a small child, she was living with her boyfriend, and things seemed to be going well at the beginning of the story, but by the end, he was breaking up with her because the chaos in her job scheduling was just too much for him to handle, because he was in school, and he just couldn't handle the fact that her schedule was shifting all the time. So in terms of the causality, you know, maybe it goes from family instability to income, but it certainly 100% goes from the chaos in jobs to what that means for children's development and what it means for people's relationships.
I'm speaking with Heather Boucher, economist who is the director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Moving to a different topic, we sort of were talking simultaneously, blending together income inequality and wealth inequality. Both are getting worse. How are they related, and how are they different, and how do they matter?
That is a big question. So income inequality is, let me just break down the basics, right? So income is what we earn, you know, at our jobs, or you earn from, you know, interest payments or something. It's the amount of cash flow. It's the money that comes in month by month or week by week that you earn over the course of a year. And wealth is the stock of money that you have in your bank account, or that you have, you know, in a house or in stocks or in, you know, investments in firms or whatever it is, equities. And so they're very different things, right? But the thing is, and to be clear, in both, what you're seeing is this trend where the top is pulling further and further apart. So there's now this, you know, by now I think it's pretty well-known curve that Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty did a number of years ago, showing that the incomes of the top 1% and top 0.01%, and as this U-shaped curve, showing that the incomes of the very top are back to where they were right before the Great Depression, and this increasing pulling apart of the top. Well, as it turns out, wealth inequality is following this same pattern. And of course, that makes sense, right? As you have this this small share of people earning these bigger and bigger annual incomes, they're saving a lot of that money and able to sort of sock it away, and it's adding up to bigger and bigger piles, stocks of money and wealth that these individuals and families have. And so the two really do go hand in hand. You know, it's not necessarily the case that the richest person in America in terms of their annual income is also the richest person in terms of the stock of wealth they have, but there's a, you know, certainly there's a high degree of overlap between the people who make a lot of money each year and the ones who are able to sort of sit on the biggest piles of wealth.
What do you see driving these trends? So there's, you know, the favorite explanation of a lot of economists is skill-based technological change, that it's just using computers and things like that. Many people have criticized that. Where do you fall on that debate?
Well, I think it's hard to argue that at least these trends at the very top, it's very difficult, I think, to make the argument that it's all just some sort of skill-based technological change for a couple of reasons. First, the increase in inequality, especially the top pulling away from the rest of us in terms of incomes, is something that has actually not happened in every country to the same degree that it's happened here in the United States. So in order for it to be about something that, you know, is about skills, you would have to think that those highly paid individuals in the United States were just that more specially skilled than the very top in other countries, other developed economies. And given the magnitude of the differences, it's a pretty tough argument to make. And if nothing else, it does sort of seem that these trends should move in concert across countries. So that's one issue. Second, the fact that you're seeing, the way that the trend is working, it really is just these very top folks really pulling apart, and a lot of them happen to be in finance or they're in management, and you see a couple of things going on in terms of those labor markets. So one, you know, this is coinciding with an increasing share of finance in our economy more generally, and, you know, to what extent is that what an economist would call rents, that is, to what extent are those highly paid salaries for those at the very top in finance, are those actually economically productive, or are they, just sort of siphoning money off the top of the economy? And then in terms of the, you know, what Thomas Piketty calls, which is, I think, a nice term, the super managers, you know, the way that salaries are set at the very top is, you know, a lot of these interlocking boards where, you know, and they're mostly men, right? They all sit on each other's boards and make the decisions about how much they're going to pay the top folks at these various organizations. And there does seem to be a little bit of a "I'll scratch your back if you'll scratch mine" kind of thing going on, where everybody's salaries are rising at the very top, but that's because they all set those salaries together. So in terms of the broader story about the rest of the economy, I don't think you have one story that explains why the very, very top is pulling apart that also explains sort of what's happening with the rest of the labor market.
The governance of corporations is not something that a lot of people think about, but what you're talking about is really important. These this small coterie of CEOs who sit on each other's boards are really stacking the corporate deck in their favor. Corporations are shoveling out vast amounts of money to their shareholders, not investing or hiring. It's almost as if we're ossifying into some kind of hereditary aristocracy.
Well, and now we're back to Thomas Piketty and feminism again, right? I think that, you know, I don't mean to be flippant, but I fear that that is where we're headed. I mean, you see this ossification at the top. You see the way that high incomes are being associated with higher increases in wealth inequality. That's not good for capitalism over the medium to long term. what you want to have a vibrant capitalist economy is you want to have people who can innovate, who can be entrepreneurs. You want the smart person with the good idea to be able to realize that idea, right? You want the next Steve Jobs who did not grow up in a wealthy family, but, you know, managed to create these beautiful devices that we all, that so many of us, you know, use every day. That those kind of folks need to be able to have opportunities, and that's one of the great things that capitalism brings. But if the stock of wealth is being concentrated in the hands of a smaller and smaller share of people, it really limits opportunity in really important ways, but it does mean that those folks can remain enormously wealthy. And when you combine that with what we're seeing in the political side, and here you know, I find some of the most depressing research I've seen in a long time by Larry Bartels and Martin Gillens, you know, who have found that policies that are supported by the wealthy tend to become enacted into law. But if they're not supported by the wealthy, they don't tend to be. And it's not 100% clear exactly what all the mechanisms are, but these are really important ways that we're not focused on creating a vibrant economy that's going to move us forward and solve our big problems and create the kinds of goods and services that'll be, you know, that are part and parcel to a dynamic economy. But it does appear that there is this calcification at the top, and it's a problem, and it's something that I think we need to be devoting a lot more of our brain power to thinking through.
And how would this sort of polarization have an effect on overall economic performance, even conventional measures like GDP and employment growth? What's the relation of these things?
It used to be that people thought that higher inequality was associated with lower growth rates. And then, you know, maybe about 15, 20 years ago, there was some dissent in the literature, and some people had come up with these new data sets and actually found very conflicting results. Over the past 5 or 10 years, though, we've been seeing more and more studies that have been showing that places that have higher inequality tend to have lower growth, especially over the long term, and or they have shorter spells of growth. And by that, I mean that places with higher inequality tend to have business cycles that are shorter, that they can't keep their economic momentum going for as long. And that's really disconcerting, and this is from studies that have been done looking at countries all across the world. One of the most cited ones is by Jonathan Austrian and Andrew Berg and some of their colleagues at the International Monetary Fund, who have found that higher inequality is associated with shorter spells of growth, and also that redistribution is actually not associated with less economic growth. In fact, actually, redistribution can be a good thing. So I think there's this emerging body of macroeconomic evidence really pointing to the conclusion that inequality is perhaps not a good thing for the economy.
And of course, now the question I always ask, but when we're down to the last minute or two, what is to be done about this? How can we address this issue?
Well, you know, I think that there are a lot of different things that we can do. One of the ways we've been thinking about it at Equitable Growth is kind of breaking it down into bite-sized buckets, looking at, okay, what kind of policies can we enact that would focus on raising incomes at the bottom, in the middle, and focus on redistribution at the top. And, you know, I think there are a variety of policies at each place that you can think of. At the bottom, of course, things like the minimum wage or the earned income tax credit can be very important. Also, things like access to universal child care, early childhood education can be absolutely critical. We know that what happens to children from 0 to 5 can make all the difference. And those kinds of policies, however, can also make a big difference in the middle of the income distribution. And then, of course, you know, as can other things like finding a better way for workers to have a voice at work. You know, only 7% of private sector workers now are represented by a union. And given the enormous concentration of incomes at the top, it does seem like sort of leveling the power dynamics might be something that we should really be focused on right now. And then at the top, there's certainly a lot of ideas vis-a-vis taxation. You know, Manuel Saez is on the board of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and one of the things that he and a number of his co-authors have done, and I should note he's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and him and a number of his co-authors have been looking at what kinds of tax policy we can implement at the top that would actually be good for the economy. And his research has shown that we could raise marginal tax rates at the top far higher than they are today. But there's other sorts of things we could do, thinking about, inheritance taxes, if we really want to sort of get at the transmission of inequality in incomes into wealth. Inheritance taxes certainly are something that we should be thinking more about.
But of course, the oligarchs who run the political system don't like to hear any of this, so we have to get out the pitchforks.
Well, I think that remains to be seen. Certainly we have some really big challenges in the United States in terms of policy. We've got, an economic recovery that has taken hold but hasn't benefited, most families yet. And I think, as we're heading into this election of 2014, it does seem like people are frustrated both with what's going on in the economy but also with a variety of other issues. I do think that Washington is going to need to find a way to deal with some of these things because people do seem to be at the end of their rope in terms of their patience.
That was Heather Boucher, Chief Economist and Director of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. And now a musical break. Some of Wasted Days by the Cloud Nothings, released earlier this year. I played some of this song a few months ago, but a different part. Next up, George Joseph. Still an undergraduate at Columbia, George Joseph has an article in The Nation magazine on Teach for America's massive publicity operation. But we also talk about TFA's mission and results. Teach for America was founded in 1989 by Wendy Kopp when she was fresh out of Princeton. Its aim is to bring recent graduates of elite universities to teach at troubled schools for a few years before they move on to politics or banking. Here's George Joseph to tell us more. Teach for America is very, very concerned about its image, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So to what lengths do they go to protect their sacred image?
Well, I wrote this piece in The Nation a few days ago about an internal media memo that we found on a open Google Doc online. And what's interesting about the memo is that obviously we knew Teach for America, like any other big corporate nonprofit, would have a communication strategy. But the extent to which they follow every single negative, quote-unquote, detractor's tweets about them and categorize the tweets as negative, positive, and then calculate how much of the social media conversation they control when oftentimes these tweet wars amount to about like 50 tweets. Just seems absurd. I don't think like 70 detractors sending a tweet about Teach for America in a negative light would be that big of a deal, but Teach for America just has millions to spend on a communications team that apparently has nothing better to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't they have anything better to do? I mean, you don't get much more ephemeral than a tweet, but I guess they're very concerned about their image. Well, and then your story is based around this memo, which was about a story that someone was writing for The Nation, right? So tell us the story of how this memo came to be.
The Nation story came out earlier this year by a woman named Alexandra Hutnick, and it was about how TFA, despite its sort of reputation or original purpose, which was supposedly to fill up schools where there was understaffing, is actually going to regions where they're explicitly told by communities that they are not wanted. In this case, Seattle was the major place focused on, and nevertheless floods districts with recruits, oftentimes leaving them in precarious job situations. It sort of went along with the whole narrative about how Teach for America is often linked to mass school closures, union busting, and teacher firings. And so my piece also developed that further by citing specific instances of this in Chicago, New Orleans, and Newark. Yeah, Newark's crazy. So Hutnick had reached out to the DOE. She had sent a FOIA request, and we're not exactly sure what happened there. I did a FOIA about her FOIA, and this didn't make it into the piece, but it seemed like the Department of Ed was taking a really long time to respond to her FOIA. And there's nothing I can prove in terms of them leaking it or that sort of thing, but ultimately TSA was notified about her request because they are a grantee of the DOE. And the extent to which that is pretty shocking. Last year, according to their latest 990 tax document form, they received $43 million from the federal government. And so, like, that amount of money, as this story shows, is going in part to fund these, like, massive PR games. Anyway, before the piece even came out, Teach for America published a preemptive critique of the piece without naming the critique, and they act as if they're very proud of themselves because they boast about how they were able to preemptively address some of the misinformation, as they put it, in the piece. And you would think that that would be enough. But then, on top of their entire communications team apparatus, when the piece came out, they hired a quote-unquote crisis communications consultant who actually has the trademark name America's Crisis Guru.
Not to demean the nation, which both of us write for, but and for which this article appeared, but this is an extremely all-points bulletin for an article in a relatively small circulation magazine. Well, why are they so paranoid?
I sort of get into that in the piece, but in the last recent years, TSA has really come under attack. It's lost the pristine nonprofit image because I think increasingly so many grassroots community groups and rank-and-file teachers have been speaking out against it, oftentimes even when the AFT and the NEA aren't willing to do so. And that has fueled a lot of more investigative pieces into Teach for America. Anyone who looks up their donor lists, in which basically every single evil corporation in the world has donated to them, Monsanto, Walmart, all the investment banks, has to know that something's up. If you add that to their lack of results, they only have one study, which I'm pretty sure is industry-funded, that shows that they have a bare improvement in terms of education outcomes through their recruits.
Yet you quote somebody as saying 7/100 of a standard deviation, which is
right.
Not very much.
One Mathematica study that they bring out every single time. And unfortunately, a lot of, you know, these quasi-research folks at, like, organizations like the New America Foundation and all these sort of corporate-backed think tanks cite those sort of things as if they were really scientifically valid. And regardless, if you look at the actual education research into Teach for America, there's nothing to suggest it does any better, especially in states where you have actual solid teacher certification requirements. The only places it is slightly better in is where states allow for online teaching education to be a valid certification, like in the South. So, like, if you have the choice between online education versus a five-week summer camp, obviously you'll take the summer camp, but that is nowhere near what someone needs to become qualified to be a teacher. So as that critique has mounted, as well as their just lack of results and the sort of strange corporate machinations behind Teach for America, I think they're really pushing to save their image because their image is all they have to stand on, and they need to get money from a lot of states' sources, and they also need to continue to push for their alternative certifications to be accepted across the country, because otherwise their recruits wouldn't be able to continue to flood into districts.
So what was the substance of Alexander Hutnick's piece that got them so exercised?
I don't really think it's actually the substance of Hutnick's piece, because that was just one case study that they chose. But if you look at every single barely negative piece about Teach for America, they will have a blog response on their, like, on the record sheet. Hutnick's piece was actually sort of generous to them, I think. she wasn't very critical about the research that they cited. She's a TSI alumni, and while, yes, I think it was a strong piece, it wasn't really the harshest thing that I've ever seen. So I think it's more about just a general reaction in complete and full throttle defense of the organization. And that's something that former TSA staffers have spoken about, like the woman I cited from the Washington Post. She was sort of became disillusioned with Teach America because on the one hand, in recent years, they have sort of shifted gears, and in order to deflect criticism on the outside, they always say, oh, we're really about welcoming dialogue and trading critiques and improving things together. But on the other hand, as this memo shows, the way that they refer to detractors is as people that they need to silence and shut down and kill on the social media level, which is typical when you're engaged in the war for privatization of the public school system.
And as you say in your piece, they spend buckets of money on public relations, right?
Yeah, they spend millions on lobbying, on PR and communications. It's all available in their 990s. They had $3.5 million on advertising and promotion, and that's just in the last 3 years. And so, unfortunately, a lot of that is publicly subsidized because the federal government, because it's probably so staffed by TSA alums, gives so much grant money to TSA.
Alexander Hutnick filed a Freedom of Information request with the Department of Education to look into their relations with Teacher America, and the program officer at the Department of Education tipped them off, right?
That's not a claim we made, unfortunately. We said that they notified them. We used the term notified carefully because it is true that as grantees of the DOE, since Hutnick was asking for grant information, Teach for America has the right to cover up sensitive names and that sort of thing. But the fact that it took them so long to respond to Hutnick leaves the potential that someone could have talked to them from the DOE, but we didn't make that claim. There's actually been a lot of critiques that have come out of the article from sort of corporate hacks because some have assumed that we claimed that the DOE leaked, and we didn't actually claim that. We just claimed that they notified, and once they were notified, TFA immediately started responding PR-wise.
But regardless of the word you use, there is a very intimate relation between Teach for America and the federal government.
Yeah, and I tried to demonstrate that by not only focusing on this memo, but also just talking about the numerous aides they have to Arne Duncan, the head of the DOE, the numerous district heads they have across the country, state senators, congresspeople, that sort of thing. Teach for America makes up 0.02% of the current teaching force, so like very small in terms of their actual classroom impact. But in terms of their political capabilities, they are enormous. And part of that is because 80% of their recruits quit after 3 years. Yet Teach for America claims that 63% of their recruits work in education. And that is just a vague term which they use to imply that their recruits are working as teachers. But really, after about 3 years, most of them go into the policy or political world, where they trot out their years of experience as justification for their expertise, quote-unquote.
Of course, a lot of them end up at Goldman Sachs, too. Right?
Yeah, I mean, there's also plenty of those, too. That's probably the other 40%.
You describe the way they have all these alums in positions of influence and power now, and it sounds like this has been part of the strategy that TFA's founder, Wendy Kopp, had all along. You quote her in an interview with Bloomberg Businessweek, in which she is pretty explicit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of interesting. Like, when people critique Teach for America for not producing actual long-term quality teachers, instead of attempting to address that, they just say, yeah, that's not our point. We're just trying to have a young crop of university elites take over the education policy world. You know, it's almost ridiculous how open they are about this, yet people continue to defend them. Yeah, as she told Business Week, she said, I think the way to understand Teach for America, this is Wendy Kopp, the TFA founder, is as a leadership development program. And so we hear so many complaints from young recruits about how they don't have enough training, how they don't have enough support, how they don't have professional development while they're starting out as teachers in these really tough districts. But when they get out, they have plenty of scholarship money and leadership development money from these institutes that Teach America sets up. For example, the Leadership for Educational Equity Institute, which I wrote about, which has gotten millions of dollars from TFA and also millions from undisclosed donors because it's a 501c4 to sort of help position their alumni into positions of power. And this has had drastic effects. I focused on three leaders, and I didn't get into them as much as I wanted to, who are alumni right now. But if you look at their track record, Michelle Rhee, TFA alumni, took over Washington schools. She oversaw massive cheating scandals, sort of promoted these sort of neoliberal reforms like pay for performance and that sort of thing, which just ended up in false test scores and a completely test-based curriculum. John White came down to New Orleans Recovery District after getting a blessing from Arne Duncan and closed every single public school in the district. And now Kami Anderson, the latest prominent TSA alumni to come to power, is running the Newark District, where she's attempting to make 40% of all the schools charter. She's massively closing down all the community schools in African American neighborhoods. And she's firing hundreds of teachers and bringing in hundreds of TFA recruits who are going to be subsidized by Walmart or the Walton Family Foundation.
I forget Arne Duncan's exact phrasing, but he said something virtually indistinguishable from what Milton Friedman said, that the Hurricane Katrina was a blessing for the New Orleans school system, right?
Yeah, he said it was the best thing to ever happen to the education system in New Orleans.
I'm speaking with George Joseph, who has a piece in The Nation magazine called This Is What Happens When You Criticize Teach for America. This agenda they have of, you know, the pay for performance and charterization and all, they say the evidence for this stuff. I mean, these are people who claim to be all about metrics and measurable results, but they actually do not produce these measurable results.
Right. Well, it's amazing. Michelle Rhee's rhetoric is often attempting to put figures on the left as these lovey-dovey hippies who aren't looking at the concrete numbers and the facts. And so she'll often, like, trot out these lines when she's talking to people at various business schools across the country and talk about how we need to shape education just like we do corporate efficiency models. And yet, her entire drive to have the Washington School District based on these sort of test score regime things ended up producing inflated test scores because teachers knew that they would be fired if they didn't produce test scores, which actual education research shows cannot be used to measure an individual teacher's performance. The whole value-added measure sort of sham, I guess is what you'd say, is supposed to be used by researchers to assess the quality of districts and maybe schools, but to try to use the significance of those scores to evaluate an individual teacher's performance in a given year is crazy. And so you have tons of stories. One just came out in the Washington Post about some of the best-rated teachers in districts being fired because of the irresponsible use of these statistics, which is just not following, like, basic rules of, like, statistical significance and that sort of thing. But they trot them out nonetheless and use them to fire maybe the bottom 20% of the teaching population, and no one really can challenge it because they have the trappings of this quantitative analysis, which again, relates to all the testing scholarship that groups like TSA bring out.
Private employers like Goldman Sachs is notorious for this, believe that if you just routinely have to fire the bottom 10 or 15% of the workforce every year to motivate.
That is exactly where Rhee got it from. Most education research shows that in order to develop high-quality teachers, they need at least 8 years in the classroom. So what we should be doing is funding professional development and subsidizing teachers' ability to go back to school and get master's degrees and that sort of thing. But instead, we're bringing in these temps, like in TFA, who have almost no experience, sticking them in the classroom, and then sort of, you know, they just quit after a few years. And it makes teaching more or less a glorified temp job, which probably helps in terms of driving down wages and that sort of thing, but does not help in any measure in terms of quality education. They treat these workers more or less like fast food workers. And, you know, that's not right either.
With Ivy League degrees, though.
Well, yeah, definitely. For Teach for America, yeah. But they don't view it as this burnout as being dangerous because they're not expected to, you know, continue on and actually take the teaching profession seriously. There's so many programs at Goldman Sachs or, you know, various hedge funds and consulting firms that actually allow Teach for America recruits to defer for 2 years. You get into one of these firms, then you go do your little teaching experience for a couple of years, then come back and, you know, laugh about it over wine with your colleagues.
Yeah, I had a woman on the show a few months ago who was a recent graduate of Duke, Laura Newland, and she wrote about how it's mostly about the influence of Wall Street recruiting on the experience of elite undergraduate education. But she has a couple of pages on Teach for America in which she said a lot of people view this as an alternative way into Goldman. If you don't make the first Goldman cut, you go TFA. Do you see that at Columbia?
Oh, it's definitely true. I don't know if you've read Karen Ho's Liquidated. It's an ethnography of Wall Street recruitment at elite undergraduate institutions. There's a lot of parallels you can draw to the way that Teach for America recruits. So they recruit Ivy League kids claiming that they've exhibited some sort of leadership quality and that sort of thing, and that therefore they really need them to give their brains, give their genius to these young kids. I saw a recent Teach for America ad that had this poor brown boy pictured in some field or something, and the Teach for America or logo says he wants to be like you someday. So it's just this sort of like valorization of elite students who have never done anything really to deserve being qualified as teachers. And yet, just as in Karen Ho's ethnography of Wall Street recruitment, where Wall Street firms will go specifically to schools like Princeton and Harvard. And when students ask, I don't have any financial experience, like, why are you recruiting me as an anthropology major? They'll say, oh, don't worry about it. You'll pick it up along the way. You know, you're smart enough. You guys are just the smartest people in the world. You can do it. And so the reason that these investment firm, banking firms do this is because when they're speaking to corporate clients, they want to have a bunch of people listed in their pitch at working on the jobs from these institutions. And in the same way, Teach for America garners a lot of its prestige when it's presenting itself to districts by being like, oh, we're going to send in all these Harvard kids to Mississippi, and that's just a rare, crazy thing that's going to really change the district. And for policymakers, they should know better, but I guess these are the sort of people that they grew up with and sort of have come to think of as the smartest people in the room. And it elides any need for actual structural fixes like anti-poverty measures or just basic school funding. And it sort of puts the entire onus of education reform or educational improvement on the sort of genius heads of these university students.
Yeah, people in their early 20s are just out of college, are supposed to work magic.
Right. And to qualify that, I think you talked to Dana Goldstein recently, who's talked about Teach for America's sort of shift. But in recent years, as TFA has come under critique for the sort of more or less missionary Ivy League model that they have had for years and years, they've really gone after students of color in terms of recruiting, and I see that on Columbia's campus often, in order to sort of counter the critiques of their program as giving the worst teachers to poor Black and Latino districts. But regardless, even if they do have a higher number of people of color in their recruiting pool now, it doesn't mean that people who have 5 weeks of training are actually qualified to teach anywhere. It doesn't matter. And it hasn't changed the results in any way. So I don't see how that's really a valid rhetorical argument.
And so finally, have you gotten the TFA treatment yet for your article?
Well, it's actually kind of funny. I was sort of hoping for it. And we did get that to the extent that Teach for America sent an immediate I think they actually had two responses, one from their on-the-record page and one from a communications person. But in terms of the Twitter game, they haven't really reacted that strongly, and I think that's because it'd just be embarrassing for them to exactly carry out what we reported on them as doing. There was some guy named, I don't remember, he was some TSA alum. He's sort of one of those pseudo-researchers. Okay, there's some guy named Connor P. Williams, who is a former TSA, and now he's sort of one of these pseudo-researchers at a think tank, the New America Foundation or something. And he basically published a critique of my article, which was a critique of a misreading of the article. You know, he argued that we had made a lot of noise about some leak, but we didn't even say that there was a DOE leak. And he used that misreading on Twitter of my article in order to claim that the entire article's argument of TSA's influence in the DOE and districts across the country was false. But that's an absurd argument if you just look at the amount of alumni who are in powerful positions in the across the country and how they're acting, which I outlined. And obviously, he failed to address because he couldn't really say anything about it. So it's been interesting. I mean, unfortunately for TSA, if you do the calculations of the amount of negative versus positive tweets they've gotten, they haven't been able to dominate the social media conversation. So that's the good news. I think their reputation is cracking, and it's happening all the time.
Okay, I'm off to tweet negatively against them now. That was George Joseph, a student at Columbia, who's got a piece in The Nation magazine on Teach for America. It's on the web at thenation.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of I Wanna Destroy You by the Soft Boys. And I do. Till next week, bye.
Tell you your opinions, and they're very good.